Welcome to Two-Way Street. My guest today is Sid Mashburn. Here's what GQ, the men's fashion magazine, had to say about Sid and his clothing store on Atlanta's West Side. Sid Mashburn is a clothing store, yes, but it's also a cathedral of style, a place where the suit is holy, service is sacred, and community is practiced and built. Frankly, gentlemen's stores like this were supposed to be extinct, but Sid resurrected the format and just as crucially updated it for the modern era. GQ went on to name Sid Mashburn the top men's clothing store in the country. Sid opened his Atlanta store in 2007. He spent many years working as a designer for some of the top designers and retailers in the business, Ralph Lauren, Tommy Hilfiger, J. Crew, Lands End, and others. And while he scored significant successes working for other people, it was his Atlanta store that really put him on the map. Here's why. Sid is very cool, and so's his store. He's made it a place not just to buy clothes, but to hang out. You can play a game of ping pong or backgammon while listening to the eclectic mix of songs playing on the record player. You can get advice on just the right cut for your slacks or sports jacket or even your jeans, which will all be custom tailored for free. If you're one of those people who worry about the hugely false image of the South and Southerners as unsophisticated rednecks, Sid Mashburn is here to tell you to stop fretting. He's got the fashion world sitting up and taking notice of the hipness of Southern style and Southern hospitality, as only a boy from a small town in Mississippi could. Sid Mashburn, welcome to Two-Way Street.
Thank you, Bill, for inviting me.
You're right down the street from our studios.
It is down a two-way street from you.
Okay. You grew up in a very small town in Mississippi.
Yes.
What's the name of it?
Brandon. It actually is on the map, but it's just off of I-20. I-20 splits Brandon on the way to Jackson. We're about 15 or 20 minutes outside of Jackson.
What was life like as a young boy growing up in a small Mississippi town?
Slowish. It was not a lot to do, but I was, pretty sated with life. I mean, it felt like there was plenty to do, but as I look back, it was not a lot. But I can remember basically go to school, play sports, take piano lessons, go to church, and that was pretty much it.
You come from a family of retailers, people in what we used to call the dry goods business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I loved clothes. And funny enough, my grandmother my grandfather had died before I was born, but she had a dry goods store. And before that, they had a hardware store and a furniture store.
Tell people what a dry goods store was.
A dry goods was basically no food, no hardware. It was basically like a clothes store, okay? From foundations to shoes to overalls, it really was kind of a department store, general store of apparel. And so what's funny is you don't even really realize how much, in my case, lint is in your blood or how connected you are to your grandparents. And so my oldest daughter was at University of Texas. She was in the English program there, and she would come home for Christmas or for the summer, and she loved working in the store. And so I told my mother that. And my mother said, well, of course she does. She says, it's in her blood. And I was like, wow, you are right. For the first time, it dawned, at the age of 47, I'm like, really? That's in my blood? So I had not made that connection.
And yet, early on, as you were looking at what you wanted to do, you did go to work in retail. What was the first store you worked at? Busick's.
And there was the Busick's actually were relatives of ours too. I think they were second or third cousins. And they had, there was Busick's menswear in Brandon, which was mostly a Western and workwear store. And so then in Pearl, which was the next town over, you had Busick's, but it was a nicer, more of an upgrade from Busick's of Brandon. And so I got a job there when I was 15 because I loved clothes.
What'd you do?
My first day there, I sorted hangers, okay, which I was like, this is not really what I came to do. But you also realize as you look back, you go, the fundamentals and the foundations of running a business is what you got to start off doing. And so Mr. Busick needed the hanger sorting. Somebody had to do it. And I was getting paid the least, and he's like, why don't I put them on it? But also, there were two guys there, Henry Torrance and Jack Busick. And they were probably at that time, I was 15, they were probably in their early 20s, and they were pretty snazzy dressers, and they were cool guys. And also, when I'd go into men's stores, I always was kind of attracted to these guys that were not just salesmen. They were kind of cool guys. And there was another store in Jackson at the time called The Rogue, which at the time was one of the best men's stores in the country. And when you walked in there, the guys, you know, there was a guy that knew about cars. There was a guy that knew about literature. There was a guy that knew about food. There was a guy that knew about travel. There was a guy that knew about music. It was like a salon. I was like, this is cool.
You said you always liked clothes.
Always.
Okay, so what era are we talking about at this point? Let's give us some years.
I was born in 61. I wrote a letter to my sister in November of 71. She was at the University of Southern Mississippi. Both of them had gone there. And I wrote her a letter saying, can you find me some green pants and a puka shell necklace? I'm nine. Okay. And my parents were a little bit like, what's up with that? They were a little bit scratching their head, but not really. I mean, they were just rolling with it.
Yeah.
After that, I go to college. I'm in my second year at Ole Miss, and I'm struggling to really, you know, the courses I like, I do well in, and others I do horribly in. But I'm having a good time and enjoying life and growing up a little bit. But I asked my dad if I could go to design school in New York, and in his inimitable Southern way, he's like, son, I'll help you go to regular school, and then you can do whatever you want. And I was like, oh, that doesn't sound great, but okay.
Was there a Southern style of dress when you were a teenager? Or do Southerners dress the way everybody dresses?
It wasn't obvious, because you thought that was the world of dressing, except for when I would open GQ and go, oh, this looks cool. And then I would picture myself in that, and then I'd go buy it.
What would it have been?
Do you remember the era of sort of the David Bowie sort of early 70s baggies, platform shoes? Okay, that's what I was into. I can remember going to the first boy-girl party where you really knew it was a boy-girl party. In the seventh grade, it was at a girl that went to another school's house, and I wore baggies and a baseball shirt, which the baseball shirt back then was like a Johnny collar, short sleeve with a banded bottom. It was pretty cool for, you know, Mississippi in that era. And platform shoes. I had two pairs of platform shoes.
Wow.
I had a blue patent leather and white patent leather. So you're probably going, really? But anyway, it was very
John Travolta.
Kind of. It was around. It was actually even pre that era.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So you did go off to New York.
I did, and this is what was cool about what my father, because they'd given me a car in college, and it was a Monte Carlo. Okay, so when I graduated from college, he said, you see that Monte Carlo? I said, yeah. He said, why don't you sell that, and that's yours, and go to New York and see if you can figure it out. So the 2 years before, when he told me, don't do this, now he was saying, okay, you can go do this. You've kind of passed the test. He didn't put it like that, but he was a pretty open-minded guy, my dad. And, you know, he had friends of all sorts and was very, very cool. And also, he liked clothes a lot. So I went to New York with straw in my hair and, you know, about $5,000 in my pocket, and got a job first in food. I was a horrible maitre d', then got recruited by a guy named Robert Lighton, who had a company called British Khaki that I loved and really thought this was great. He gave me a job as a salesperson, but he taught me how to design.
Your wife, yes. Anne, you have side-by-side stores here in Atlanta, Anne Mashburn and Sid Mashburn, she was at Vogue magazine working.
Well, did you see the movie The Devil Wears Prada?
Yeah, of course. How many times?
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I have a daughter and a wife at home, you know, Sid. So I've seen it many times.
Well, she worked for Polly Mellon, who, after Donna Vreeland, was really kind of the fashion director. She was called the fashion editor. I mean, it was a very unglamorous title, but she ran all the creative for Vogue. And the editor-in-chief back then was Grace Mirabella. And so Anne learned from the best of the best, and she worked with, you know, Richard Avedon as a photographer, and Steven Meisel, and all these fantastic photographers, but also worked with, you know, she was on Cindy Crawford's first fashion shoot and Elle McPherson. And it was a pretty great time to be in that business. And We met on the beach at Long Beach, Long Island.
You've told a couple of interviewers that that I think pretty quickly after you met, she told you about a startup company operating in New Jersey.
Yes.
Going to do mail order.
Yes, which is not very glamorous.
New Jersey mail order.
That's right. And
catalog. It's not what I think of when I think of Sid Mashburn today.
Well, you know what? This is a great, that's a great call out, Bill, because really, what was really nice is the clay was really unmolded. It was J. Crew, and this was 1985, and her good friend had left Vogue to go work for this startup catalog company in New Jersey. And so we'd had to reverse commute, so we would leave Manhattan to go over. I'd go to Port Authority and hop on a bus and go over to Garfield, New Jersey, which, again, is not very J. Crew or glamorous. And we would work there for, you know, all hours of the day because I was still learning how to become a designer. But what was really interesting about there and Ralph Lauren that I went to work for later and Tommy Hilfiger is you don't – you have to execute someone else's vision before you really can find your voice. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to – I think age is very underrated, you know, in finding your voice and finding out really what you want to communicate.
What does that mean?
I think experience is a great shaper of what you want to say to people because in the end we're telling a story, but it can't be – it's not a fable. It's a real story. We want it to really be an authentic expression of who we are and what we do, what we like, what we can afford, what appeals to us, who we're interacting with. It's a novel. And so it was great for J. Crew because there was enough white space on the page that we were helping shape the look, but also we had some restrictions.
Did you design a jacket or a coat at J. Crew that became rather popular?
Yes.
Tell us about it.
It was the barn jacket. And basically what I did, because since I was not a trained designer, I took about, I can remember looking at all the jackets. There's probably about 12 or 13 different jackets that I looked at and said, I like this detail. I like that detail. And then I built these very elaborate, what we call tech packs, okay, with a measurement of every single square inch of the jacket down to how many stitches per inch, what the button placement is, what the neck drop is, the neck width, the back neck drop, what the armhole shape is, and also what, not besides doing just the measurements, how do we want it shaped? Mm-hmm. You know, what the flange and back looks like, what are the pockets going to be like, what's it going to be lined with, what's the fabric going to be? So it's a volume of details that that goes into the making of a product. And when you know, shirts, or I'd say trousers are probably the easiest thing to make, okay, from a pattern perspective, because you think about it, it's a front, it's a back, it's a rise, it's a waistband. Shirt starts to get more complicated because people are shaped differently, whether it's their chest, they're barrel-chested, or they're narrow-shouldered, or they're very slope-shouldered, or they're very square-shouldered. They've got a narrow neck on a big body, or vice versa. So then shirts are your next dimension, and then tailored clothing, which is jackets, becomes it's almost a four-dimensional play. And then outerwear is kind of that same same ilk. And so when I built this jacket, it was just taking everything I could find in the kitchen and throwing it all in a pot.
What did it look like? We'll actually find it and post a picture of it on our website.
But it was called the J. Crew Barn Jacket, and it looked like a hunting jacket, but of kind of an urban. Okay, so and it was very popular on college campuses, and a lot of people didn't really totally understand the appeal of J. Crew. I would suggest, beside it looking cool, the pictures. And this is the other thing is when I was 26 years old, and I did the barn jacket, and you know, all of a sudden it was a $10 million a year item. I thought I did it. I didn't stop to think that, you know what, the people who shot it, the model who was wearing it, the person who sourced it, the person who, you know, helped him with the technical package. I didn't see the team aspect.
Sure. You know, what's interesting to me about your description of building a jacket is, you know, for anyone who's ever custom built a home, a house, once you have the basics all put together and the framing is going up, you think, well, good, it's all done. And then they come back at you and say, well, what kind of doorknobs did you want? How did you want your windowsills finished? What? And all of a sudden, what do you mean, what kind of doorknobs? I want a doorknob. And they, well, here's a catalog with 10,000 doorknobs.
Right.
So you're talking about a jacket in a very similar sort of way.
And you make a lot of mistakes. Okay? So you know, in a way, I was being paid by J. Crew to learn, you know, not just to satisfy their coffers, but, you know, for me to learn.
If you're just joining us, my guest is men's clothing designer and retailer Sid Mashburn. His store on Atlanta's West Side has become one of the most acclaimed men's retail shops in the country. When we come back, Sid has some tips about how you may want to dress. One hint, think twice about pleats. First to break. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest today is Sid Mashburn. He's a men's clothing designer and retailer whose store on Atlanta's West Side has been proclaimed by a number of national fashion magazines the top men's shop in the country. Now, we need to say that Sid Mashburn is not an inexpensive place to shop, but as we pick up, he describes the philosophy that he learned from Sears. You have to feature items that are good, better, and best, and cover all price ranges.
Okay, so Levi's would be good. The better would be ours. And today, ours, and for instance, in footwear, Edward Green would be the best, okay, which we would say is arguably the finest.
So I can buy a pair of Levi's from you for $65.
Yes.
I can buy one of your shirts for about $150.
It starts at $125 and goes up from there. And then a pair of Edward Green shoes will cost you about $1,200 or $1,300. But you'll have them your whole life, and all you have to do is change the tires every 4 or 5 years. So get it resold for $150 to $200. It's just like a car, but you will keep it forever if you take decent care of it. And that's also, we're fairly frugal when it comes to purchasing. Yes, we have expensive stuff, but also it warrants it because we don't cut any corners on the make nor on the ingredients. We want the best of the best.
Does everybody across the country, without regard to certain beachwear, say in Southern California, dress pretty much the same these days?
No. I would suggest that your Northwestern dresser is a different sort of dresser. And forget the idea that sort of that's, you know, arguably the birthplace of grunge. Not that everybody dresses like that or like a lumberjack. I mean, that wasn't the original hipster outfit that came from there. But even the people who dress up there dress a little bit differently. New York, you get a little bit of everything, I think. In California, like you said, is a much more casual culture. Besides the beachwear, just everybody to dress up. They don't even wear very many ties out there. The South has always, you know, there's, I think you can find, if you go online, the constant debate about Southern prep versus Ivy League and who really was the progenitor of that. And it doesn't really matter to us. We just like certain things that also stand the test of time. Unfortunately, I think that the term preppy becomes pejorative, but it's actually just kind of more of a pointing to something that's super classic, that's right in any sort of setting. And that's kind of what our look is about. We like for it to be appropriate for any setting. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Please. No. You've said essentially that to you, preppy is basically, as you point out, a classic look, but it's also maybe having something a little bit askew. The pocket square is wrinkled. The necktie, what?
Just, you know what, I don't study tying my tie in the mirror in the morning. I just do it, and I'll take a quick look at it and go. And I think for men, for me, I don't want to look. I want to take as few shots in the mirror as possible. I just kind of want to make sure my hair's combed back and I don't have anything that's too distracting.
Yes, but that's also a look, Sid. That's not just, oh, I don't care. It's a cultivated look to some extent. The tie that you're wearing, the tail is longer than the, what do you call this part, the front?
The apron, yeah.
The apron.
Yeah.
That's a fairly, I mean, you do that with some intention, right?
Not especially, no.
Okay.
Because you know what? Yesterday, I don't think it did that. And tomorrow, who knows? So.
See, I can't do it because ties are never long enough for me.
Yeah,
I
mean, I've got a
long waist.
Long torso.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
So my ties are always, that tail is always like.
Yeah, well, and also for guys who have a shorter torso, they wrap the tie twice on a four in hand so that they don't have that problem.
Okay, but let's go back to that in general. Preppy is classic, but with a little, some casual aspect.
Sure.
Maybe you're not wearing socks. Do you ever wear socks anymore?
I do. I'm wearing them today, but oftentimes I don't. I just like not wearing socks. But sometimes I wear, particularly with shoes like this, with really, you know, sort of serious dress shoes, I'll put socks on.
If you're going to the Metro Chamber of Commerce to give a talk to business leaders, would you be comfortable going in there without wearing a suit without socks?
It depends on if it's 95 outside and I'm wearing a khaki poplin suit, I'll wear some loafers without socks.
Okay.
Particularly if it's a Thursday or Friday. If I'm heading into the weekend. So I am super conscious of the setting I'm going into. And really, Bill, in a funny way, minding my manners.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be respectful of where I'm going.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I'm going to an older person's funeral, and it's going to be mostly older people, I'm wearing socks.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
For my dad's funeral, I didn't wear socks.
Yeah. Let's talk about slacks. Southern boys wear their pants too short.
Not
what do
really.
You call that look? The
high water?
High water.
Yeah. Well, okay, so there's a rationale we have about that.
Okay.
And sometimes mine feel a little shorter than they should, but I really would prefer that than having them too long.
Because
when you wear them too long, it makes you look shorter.
So where should the bottom of my, in this case, jeans, my slacks, where should they hit?
If I just met you for the first time, okay, and you came in my store, and I've got a guy who's a very, very, very successful lawyer here in town who wanted our look, and I was like, no, you really don't. And he insisted that he did. And then I spoke to his wife months later, and she's like, he never wears those pants. Okay. And we told him that you shouldn't do that. And we're not there to dictate, but we are there to shape and guide. Okay. So we prefer for ourselves, all the guys in the store, like no break in trousers. Okay,
and that's for everything, including one of your, say, $7,000 suits.
For sure. Yes, for a particular guy. Now, if I'm a guy who maybe works in Washington, okay, since you discussed Washington, or I'm a lawyer who travels around the world, and a lot of people in Atlanta travel a lot, I would probably suggest a very light break, okay? Just something that touches the top of your shoes and has a slight break to it. And that way you still get a pretty clean line, because that's our rationale again, is you're looking for an uninterrupted line in what you're wearing.
That makes sense.
Okay?
Speaking of that, you mentioned when you were first designing, I asked you about sewing, and you said, well, no, I could describe how it should look. And you talked about, even back 20 years ago, skinnier pants.
Yes.
I was probably married for 10 years before my wife finally said to me one day, if the next pair of slacks you buy have pleats,
you're done.
I'm leaving you.
Well, when we came to Atlanta, I think I kind of joked that it was the official pant of Atlanta.
All right.
It was the pleated khaki.
But that's all part of the same thing, isn't
it? Yeah. Well, this is the thing is for us, you know, my big fashion influences, besides my sisters and my brother, who of course got best dressed when he was in high school, and he was a fantastic dresser. He's a very small guy. And so at that time, the guys who were shaping fashion to me were the I Spy guys, the men from Uncle, okay? Sidney Poitier in The Heat of the Night, Dick Van Dyke on the Dick Van Dyke Show. All of these guys wore a very natural shoulder, a slightly shorter jacket, clothes closer to the body, okay? And what that does is it's more flattering to everybody because you lose weight without losing weight. So visually, you cut a slimmer look by having clothes that fit you. And what happens with men or with women, if they're feeling a little bit larger or overweight, they will buy bigger clothes to disguise. And actually what it's doing is it exacerbates.
So there are no such thing as pleated slacks in a Sid Mashburn store.
We do have pleated slacks.
Oh, I thought you didn't.
No, we have a single pleated, but it's pretty slim cut.
Okay.
And so it's just a slightly different look.
You build jackets differently too than if I were buying it at a big retail store. What's it called? The construction?
Full canvas.
What does that mean, full canvas?
We basically have five makes of jacket, Bill. So we have a completely unstructured or unconstructed jacket, which would be in corduroy or cotton or a twill or something that's really knock around. Something, it's kind of almost a backseat jacket to have a jacket when you go to a place that says you got to have a jacket, all right? But also it's a great place because we treat our jackets in the store like a purse, okay? So my phone goes in the lower left-hand pocket, my keys go here, my pens go here, my glasses go here. This is a work jacket. So in a sense, it's almost like a cargo coat, okay, or like cargo pants. The second jacket we make is a half canvas. So that means the canvas, it's a piece. It's really the exoskeleton of the jacket, okay? So it's made of horsehair and wool, okay, or camel hair and wool. And what that does is it gives you shape to your chest and gives some structure and support here because otherwise the wool by itself could just collapse, okay? We like very, very, very little shoulder. We like to see the real man underneath the jacket.
I think men's clothes are boring compared to women's clothes. Women are allowed to really use color, patterns. There are a lot of ways in which women can really make a statement with their clothes. Now, I understand within certain parameters, you make a statement with your clothes, clearly. But it's harder. I mean, I wear happy socks from Bloomingdale's when I wear socks. Because it's the only place I can do something
to express
really
yourself.
Fun.
Right.
Are men's clothes just inherently never going to be as interesting as you had those green slacks and the puka shell necklace.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You got it.
Well, this is the thing is when a guy comes in the store, you have to kind of, you know, there's a couple of things. When a man walks into our store, your EQ has to be pretty strong if you're going to take care of him. So you got to sense immediately, is this guy in a hurry? Because if he's not, I'm going to offer him a cold drink or a hot drink and let him just wander and sit down and check his text and enjoy himself. Otherwise, he says, I'm catching a plane. I need a shirt and tie. And you got to sense that immediately because you don't want to come off as, I want to push you into something too quickly. But you also have to respect that a guy needs to get in and out. Same thing comes when a guy says, this is what I'm looking for. You have to kind of sense a little bit of what his style is. And sometimes it actually can be offensive to some guys because we ask them, tell me about your life. What do you do? Do you travel? We're looking for cultural context so we can really help him do what he wants to do. If you ask us for our prescription of what we would give a man is something that's quiet-ish, but there is a lead singer in the band, okay? Today, my lead singer is this polka dot mock tie, okay? The rest of it, and also that this is a medium blue heathered suit, but you don't want multiple lead singers in a man's outfit, okay? Women can get away with a little bit more of that, but some guys do. You know, some guys want to go that way. But another way for us to express it is, like you said, with your happy socks, boxers. You know, we'll do a lot of Liberty prints in boxers because it's underneath. So a guy still feels like he's expressing himself, but he's not showing it.
Interesting.
Okay. Ties and pocket squares are probably the most obvious way for guys, certainly in a business setting, to express themselves because we do like colorful ties a lot.
I have a Sid Mashburn pocket square with me today.
Do you like it?
I love it. Yeah. I don't even want to talk about what it costs, but I love it.
But you'll get to wear it for a long time. That's the other thing is when we buy things, we plan on keeping them in our closet for 30 years.
Have you ever considered whether you should have some kind of logo on your clothes?
I can't tell you how many people tell me that we should need a
logo.
Well,
I mean, certainly.
And so we have.
We
have, for sure.
It strikes me there are two different kinds of people in the world. There are people who, like me, really don't want it. I don't want to be branded. And then there are people who, if they're shopping at Sid Mashburn's, they'd like to tell the world, yes, I did spend this amount of money for this shirt I'm wearing.
Yeah, and I can understand that. And the thing is, on our polo shirt, we have on the bottom of the tail, there's a SM. And on the back of our ties, some of them we embroider on the back of SM. Other than that, we don't really do that. And we've talked about it a lot. And we have a really cool little logo that my daughter did that's Sid and Ann. It's cute. I won't say we never will.
Right.
But right now, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like it's kind of earned its place.
So what's around the corner in men's fashion? What are you thinking about today for 2017, 18, and beyond?
Ways of taking things that are already somewhat understandable and putting a flourish or a twist on them. Okay?
You have an example of that?
Yeah, we took a pair. I would suggest that maybe khaki pants, in a funny sense, are the white bread of men's wardrobes, right? Okay, but they're also a fantastic canvas to build around. So it's a great place to put a batik shirt on, or a seersucker jacket, or a pair of white bucks, you know, because it's really part of the foundation of what your wardrobe mm-hmm. can be. But we said, you know what, sometimes khaki pants unto themselves are a little flat. So we sell a lot of African beads, okay? And we buy them from a guy who brings them in from Ghana, okay? We love them because, again, it's a way for me to express myself without showing that I'm expressing. I feel good because I'm wearing them.
Yeah, we should tell our listeners that you had to unbutton your button of your shirt because it's hidden behind the white shirt you're wearing. But go ahead.
But it makes me feel good. So
it's a very slender green jade kind of green. Yeah. Are they little stones?
Yeah, just African beads.
Really pretty.
Yeah, thank you. And so what we did is we took the khaki pants and we beaded the pockets. Okay, so again, when you look at them, they're still a pair of khaki pants. But when you pull your jacket back, you're like, we like the second look.
That's what I'm talking about, giving men an option to make a little statement.
But it still feels accessible.
Yeah.
I'm not going weird. You know, I'm not wearing a pair of three-legged pants, you know. So that's around. And also, I think guys will be dressing up a little bit more. Compared to where they've gotten to, because it's interesting because we're right next door to JCT Bar and also by Bacchanalia and Taqueria over in the west side. And so what's interesting is when you see couples going to the bars, the girls are inevitably always in a dress and really dressed up, and the guys are wearing cargo shorts. And not all guys by any means, but a lot of guys, and you go, guys want to stay younger in their dressing, and girls almost want to be a little more mature in a funny sense.
We'll continue our conversation with men's clothing designer and retailer Sid Mashburn in a moment. Sid's famous for his eclectic taste in music, and now that he's offered you some fashion tips, we're going to get a list of his favorite records.
The people from bad homes who again and again. It's big and it's flat, full of tension and fear. They do it over there, but we don't do it here. Fashion, turn to left. Fashion, turn to right. Fashion.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. Let's continue our conversation with men's clothing designer and retailer Sid Mashburn. As we move forward, we're going to talk about music. Sid sells records at his clothing store, and his eclectic tastes have drawn attention from the national media.
I noticed that on your website right now, you are featuring the LP, the original soundtrack to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh, yeah, we love
it. Why?
I love Ennio Morricone.
Okay.
I mean, and I mean, how brilliant that you have this Italian guy who takes Western culture. It's a little bit like, were you an Elton John fan?
Yep.
Okay, Bernie Taupin and Tumbleweed Connection. You know, you've got this Englishman who's writing these Western sort of mini sagas. So music, we find a lot of messaging and life stories in. And we, our friend Alton Brown said early on, he said, when he came in the store, he's like, oh, you guys are liner notes people. It's like, yeah, we want to know the bass player.
You are so well thought of now by the national media, the New York media, that Esquire magazine actually published your top 40, your Spotify top 40 song list. And it's really diverse. Time of the Preacher, which is Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger, is listed as number one.
You know what's funny is that was the
Time of the Preacher.
That song, I listened to Little Willie Nelson. That song became more important here. We would play that almost every morning when we opened the store. The first guy that worked for me, Randy Piles, and Kwong Dao, our master tailor, who was nothing short of a gift from God, It was us three in the store. And then we hired, Randy left, and then two guys came in, Pete Samuelson and Matt Lambert. And we were collecting albums from each other. We just brought them all together. And so I don't know if it was Pete or Matt that started playing that Redheaded Stranger, but we would play it literally every morning.
We should tell our listeners that if they're not familiar with it, that is Willie Nelson's classic concept album. It's a story.
Oh, yeah.
That record.
Absolutely. And it just, you know, it's a little bit like the way we treated the Miles Davis. It's kind of blue, almost like you could put it on a loop. And every time you listen to it, there's something new that kind of comes out of it.
Howlin' Wolf is on here. Killing Floor.
It's powerful.
Yeah. Well, you're a Southerner.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
right.
Southern blues.
Lord, I wouldn't be yellow night. Down on the killing floor.
Stone Soul Picnic is on here. And the only thing I would fault you for on that is you have the fifth dimension.
As opposed to Laura
Nero.
You
ought to have Laura Nero, who wrote the song. And who is an artist of, you know, unparalleled.
Red, yellow, honey, sassafras, and moonshine. Red, yellow,
she was in the Brill Building, along with Jerry Goffin, Carole King. I mean, that talk about brilliance, unbridled. She also wrote Eli's Coming.
She wrote everything.
God,
I mean, she
was
wrote
brilliant.
Eli and the 13th Confession. She wrote Wedding Bell Blues.
Oh, Wedding Bell Blues. How fantastic.
Everybody
is that?
Recorded Laura Nero's songs.
Yeah.
And thank goodness just a couple of years ago, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame initiated her because any female artist, particularly you talk to today, will say it was Laura Nero who influenced her work.
Right. So. Well, you know, the Fifth Dimension, though.
Good group.
They got a little bit of a bad rep. Billy Davis Jr., Marilyn McCoo.
Yeah.
I mean, how about Will You Marry Me, Bill? That's another great one.
So it's an interesting look. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to post a link to it.
Okay, fantastic.
On the website so people can hear. All right, so.
Did I put any Randy Newman on there?
How do you not have Randy Newman?
I don't know, but I'll tell you, a big record for me in high school was his Rednecks record.
Sure.
Do you know that one?
God. We're Rednecks. Rednecks.
Yeah. And that flood of 1927 and Marie.
Yep.
And a wedding in Cherokee County.
Yep.
I loved you the first time I saw.
Sid Mashburn, it's just really fun getting to talk to you. Thanks for being here, Sid.
Thank you so much, Bill. You're really kind. I appreciate it.
They seek him here. They seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion.
Sid Mashburn's Atlanta store has been so successful that he's expanded to two other cities, Dallas, and more recently, Washington, D.C. If you want to learn more about Sid and his stores, and if you want to see his complete Spotify music playlist, check out the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS, or come to our Facebook page.
Oh, yes, he is.
Oh, yes, he is.
He thinks he is a flower.
Now that Sid Mashburn has shared his suggestions for taking care of the outer man, we thought we should take a look at how we can do a better job taking care of the body that our clothes hang on. With hot weather back and plenty of opportunities for outdoor activities, we wanted to revisit a portion of our conversation with Dr. Randy Martin. He's one of the most accomplished and highly respected cardiologists in Georgia. And as you'll hear, he devotes a lot of time in his practice to teaching patients how to stay well through fitness. We first broadcast our conversation with Dr. Martin in February.
I became interested in fitness because I was a chubby kid in high school, and I decided I had to lose weight. So I started running at night.
And you were running at a time, this was in what?
We're talking the 50s, the 50s. Bill. 50s. Nobody was running.
Yeah, this wasn't people out in there.
I tell a funny story. I was living in Coral Gables, Florida, where this one night I was running, and I didn't have, you know, Air Jordans or anything.
Yeah, well, nobody did.
I think I had the old sneakers. And a policeman came up and said, "Son, are you okay? Is somebody chasing you?" And that was what it was. So anyhow, I found that, because I was a short little chubby guy, so I couldn't play football. I could have been the football, but I couldn't play baseball. I wasn't fast in track. I couldn't play basketball. But I found that over the years running, I really enjoyed the feeling of fitness. And in fact, I got to in some crazy times where I really enjoyed heavy physical exertion, marathons, running up and down mountains, stuff like that. And there is no doubt in my mind that there is a release of natural, you know, endorphins, okay, morphine-like substances, because there clearly is something like that. But out of that, Bill, I became very interested in wellness and fitness. And I would say that the major thing that your listeners need to know, and we all need to know, is that chronic diseases of modern society, heart disease, cancers, strokes, things like that, respiratory diseases, are not just genetics. Genetics plays a small role in that. It's lifestyle, and we need to practice what Dean Ornish has called lifestyle medicine.
What does that mean?
Okay. So what are lifestyle the things medicine we need to means, know? Lifestyle medicine means that if you do, in fact, the favorite title that I have from one of our medical journals was called Healthy Living is the Best Revenge. If you didn't smoke mm-hmm. or stop smoking and aren't exposed to secondhand smoke, which we call as death by proxy, if you don't smoke, if you're not overweight or obese, and we could talk about that at length, and that's not a cosmetic problem, that's turning on the burners inside your body to increase your risk of heart disease, cancer, big time, all these sort of things. So if you don't smoke, you're not obese or overweight. If you eat like we live in the south of France, the old south of France or Greece, we eat a Mediterranean-type diet, and you exercise 150 minutes a week. And I'm talking about walking. Walking is the best thing. Gardening. Dancing, if you like to do it. As we say, sitting is the new smoking. So basically, if you do those four things, you can prevent nearly 80 to 90% of chronic illnesses. If you start them early, it's equally important. So those four things, Bill, is lifestyle medicine. Then there's things like stress modification, which is very important. Meditation is incredibly, prayer is incredibly important, and social interaction. We are meant to be connected to each other. So family, friends, incredibly important to have those social connections. So that's lifestyle medicine.
When you try to convince somebody to give up smoking, that's got to be a tough sell.
It's very, very difficult, Bill. And I mean, you know, they can look at me and say, you know, you look like a little anorexic Jack Russell if I'm overweight and I'm smoking and stuff. Like, but no, I mean, I think that, you know, with smoking per se, nicotine is one of the most, if not the most, addicting substance known to man. So once you start smoking, it is very hard. I mean, it just basically lops onto your pleasure centers in your brain, and you just can't give it up. So helping people to stop smoking is really difficult, and there are multiple mechanisms for that. And you just have to keep encouraging them and get them the type of help and get their friends to help them. There are all sorts of ways to do that. Some medication helps, but that's important. I think the harder thing is to get people to you know, I mentioned this thing about, you know, not smoking, not becoming overweight. How do you get people to lose weight and eat right? And it's, you know, if I told you red meat is bad for you, and you said, gee, I like hamburgers every day and I like a lot of red meat, I'd say, you got to cut back. I didn't say go away from it, but you got to cut back. And in being overweight, you've got to start with small steps. I mean, I tell people, if you just eat 100 less calories a day, you're going to lose some weight. You lose 6 to 7 pounds. If you walk a mile, that's burning 100 calories, and eat 100 less, now you're going to lose 10 to 12 pounds in a year. We gain weight. It's called the weight creep. From the time we're 25 to 55, we gain about a pound a year. Okay, so you wake up at 55 and you're 30 pounds overweight or whatever it is. So if they're really morbidly obese, then they're, you really do have to get special help. But I tell people just try to start losing weight by, you know, not by exercising a little bit more and cutting out evening eating, okay, meaning snacking after 8 o'clock at night, and, you know, make your evening meal smaller and try to eat healthier, and we go through that. It's a matter of trying to convince people that they'll feel better if they live healthier is really important. It's not a matter of living longer. It's feeling better. But I'll tell you this. What people don't realize is that if you develop multiple heart attacks and have heart failure, okay, or if you are markedly overweight and it increases dramatically your risk of cancer, esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, those sort of things, that's not a fun way to end your life and die. So you're not trying to live forever. You're trying to live healthier so you can be active with your friends and your family or whoever you want to be and feel better on a day-to-day basis.
You said walking. So I continue to work out 7 days a week, and I always feel like I'd better push myself. So I don't walk. I ride a bike, and I push it hard. I do an elliptical trainer. I push it hard. Should I stop? Should I take it easy on myself?
No. I mean, you know, I did a lot of heavy endurance stuff. There is some evidence that if you went out and did a triathlon, okay, and really banged it, that's probably not good for your heart. Now, the heart recovers, but it's probably not good. No, I think that for the average person, just walking is fabulous, okay? But you can push it. You just don't want to run. There's no sense in running your heart wide open for an hour, okay? So I try to tell people walking is structurally the simplest thing for you. It's a great way to help you. I mean, exercise is the most powerful antioxidant we have. Exercise grows new brain cells, new brain connections. It will decrease your risk of heart disease, cancers, breast, colon cancer, decreases your risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. And in fact, it's one of the best treatments for depression, not heavy duty depression. So it's a fabulous, and walking is the simplest thing to do.
I used to work out 4 or 5 days a week. And then a doctor told me that he worked out 7 days a week. That doctor happened to have been you. And from that moment on, you set a new benchmark.
Well,
for me,
you know,
Dr.
I'm not Martin. I'm not sure I'm being biblical, because the seventh day should be a day of rest. And a lot of people do that. I just, you know, I'm addicted to exercise, okay?
So you still are.
I still am. I'm still exercising. I mean, I'm in my 70s, and I still beat my brains out every morning for about an hour now, and you know, so and I'm not a morning person, though it gets harder and harder. But no, for the average person, exercising is a great way to get a handle on lots of things. So you know, it's don't, if you have a job that means you sit all day, you got to figure out a way to get up every 5 minutes and move around. You could have a standing desk. Mm-hmm. You could have meetings, walking meetings. You can talk on the phone. Don't sit in front of the television and overeat. If you're going to watch television, stand up.
Yeah, that was fascinating that you described sitting as the new smoking.
It is literally. And in fact, the danger was sitting. And so we're a sitting society.
Yeah.
The kids sit. Everybody sits, watches television, does games on your device and all that stuff. You sit at work all day long. It is incredibly bad for our bodies. And in fact, the scary thing is leisure time activities like walking don't counteract totally the effects of sitting all day or sitting at home. So it really is, sitting is described as the new smoking. You know, smoking used to be the number one cause of death and disability in this country. Interestingly, now, this will shock you, improper diet is the number one cause, because improper diet leads to obesity, and obesity is absolutely a major problem in civilized and industrialized areas. So sitting contributes to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Staying alive. That's Randy Martin, one of Georgia's best-known cardiologists, sharing his tips for wellness. We first talked to Dr. Martin in February. We're about out of time for this week's edition of Two-Way Street. If you want to listen to our show on your own schedule, subscribe to the Two-Way Street podcast on iTunes or listen at our website, gpb.org/TWS. Our interns are Caroline Hayes and Hannah Rose Adams. Our producer is the remarkable Jenny Amond. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you back here again next week for another Two-Way Street.